sunk on a way from Stranraer to Larn. I was on duty up in the light room. As she went past the lighthouse on her way out from Stranraer, it was a terrible night, terrible stormy night. You know, I was thinking of the old saying, heaven help sailors on a night like this. I thought, blimey, I wouldn't like to be on that boat crossing tonight. And then she went down, there was quite a loss of life. Forget how many people were lost on it. Well, there at Causewell Point, I think it was about a couple of weeks, no more. And then there was a telephone call come for me from the lighthouse board in Edinburgh. They told me to go home to the Isle of Man and get my family sorted out, and to await there the arrival of the lighthouse vessel Hesperus. And I was going to be posted to the Pentland Skerries in Orkney, up in the Orkney Islands. So I would take the family on board the Hesperus at Douglas, and they would take us to Stranraer. Then from there we'd go to Glasgow by train, and then from Glasgow to Thurso, right up in the north of Scotland, up in Caithness, right on the northern coast of Scotland, by train. So I set off, I went home, and we were wondering what it would be like in Orkney. It was so far away. I'd known chaps who'd been in the Navy and they'd been up there at Scapa Flow. They used to always say what an awful place it was. And I'd heard about the train journey from Glasgow up to Thurso. They had a nickname for it, I think it was called the Kitchener Express. Anyway, we got sorted out, and eventually the day arrived when the Hesperus came into Douglas. It wasn't a very big boat, the Hesperus. The lighthouse, Northern Lighthouse Board, they had the Hesperus, which serviced the Isle of Man and the west coast of Scotland. And then they had another one up in Orkney, based in Orkney, which done all the Northern Islands and the Northern Lighthouses, which was called the Pole Star. And then at Leith, they had another vessel called the Isle of May, named after an island in the Firth of Forth. She serviced the stations on the east coast of Scotland. Anyway, we awaited the arrival of the Hesperus and then sang our farewells to family and friends. We boarded the boat alongside the pier at Douglas, and we set off. It wasn't too bad weather. The weather wasn't too bad at all, so we had a reasonable sail, and the crew were very, very good. Of course, our daughter, Linda, she was only a few months old, and they were very good for her. The cook warmed the milk and made bottles for Nina. Well, they couldn't have been any more helpful. Well, we arrived off Stranraer, but they put the anchor down, and then they lowered the ship's boat, so we had to climb down a ladder into the ship's boat. They lowered the baby down, and Nina was a bit afraid, I think. And then our bits of furniture and luggage and one thing or another, and they took us ashore to Stranraer. So they sorted us up at the railway station and then said their goodbyes. And we set off for Glasgow. When we got to Glasgow, of course, we had to change trains for this long journey. We weren't looking forward to it at all, especially with the baby. But the cook on the boat had made some feeds up and put them in thermos flasks for us, so we were all right with that respect. Anyway, we got on board the train there and we set off. It wasn't very full, and it seemed to take hours and hours and hours. It wasn't a fast train at all, of course. And as we started driving north, we'd pull up at the isolated spots where there'd just be perhaps a little hut or nothing at all. And they'd drop some parcels off and perhaps a mailbag and pick up a milk urn, a couple of few milk urns and things like that. We seemed to be stopping every 40 minutes or so on the way. It seemed to stop everywhere. And most of the places we stopped at, there wasn't a thing in sight. Nevertheless, eventually, after God knows how many hours, we arrived at Thurso. Now that's right on the northern coast of Scotland. So we got off the train there, and then we found we had to get a bus or a taxi. I think we got a taxi, that's right, down to a little place called Scrabster. It's not far from Thurso. We had to go there to pick up the boat to Orkney. So we arrived down at the quayside at Scrabster. And there was this tiny, filthy, dirty little boat. My God, I thought it was a little tug or something. But when I asked, they said, oh no, this is the St. Olaf, the Orkney ferry. God knows when she was built. I think she must have been built in the last century. It didn't stay on the run long after we got there. They got rid of it, God knows where, and got a new one, a more modern boat. But it was filthy. It was a coal-burning steam. There was only a crew of about six. Anyway, we got aboard there, and there was no decent cabins. It smelled and stank down in this little saloon place, and Nina said, oh, I'll be sick if I stay there. Let's go up and sit on deck. So we sat on deck there, and the smoke from the funnel was terrible. We were covered in soot. We were in a terrible state. And it got quite rough. Nina wasn't feeling too well at all. I wasn't too 100% myself. Anyway, we steamed round the coast there, round the past the stack, the rock stack called the old man of Hoy, and we arrived at Stromness, which was to be our home for the next 4.5 years. We were really glad to get off the boat, I can tell you, especially Dana. So we got a taxi from there up to where they were building these houses for the lighthouse board. Around the Orkney Islands, there's several very, very tiny islands which had lighthouses built on them. And they were called island stations, where there were three lighthouse keepers, their wives and their children. They all lived on these little islands. They only came ashore for holidays. It must have been awful like that. Anyway, when we arrived there, there were still these island stations. There was the Pentland Skerries, the one that we were going to, Copensay, and Oskerry, these three islands. So what the idea was, they were going to change them from island stations and make them into what they call rock stations. That meant the families lived ashore, the shore station, and just the men went out and done duty at the lighthouse on the islands. So when there were island stations, there were three keepers and their families. But when they became shore stations, they had to have four keepers so that one would be ashore while three were out on the lighthouse on duty. You'd done 6 weeks duty out on the station and then a fortnight ashore. So each station was being increased by one man. So what the lighthouse board had done, they built three blocks of flats just on the outskirts of Stromness. Brand new, they were beautiful flats. And they were, as I say, they were in three blocks, one to each station, one for Oscarry, one for Copensay, and one for the Pentlands Jetties. Each block had two flats on the ground floor and two flats above. And the flats above were reached by outside staircases, stone staircases. So everyone had their own door. There were gardens front and rear, and they had all mod cons. There were two bedrooms, a good sized lounge, a great big square kitchen, and a bathroom and toilet. And downstairs outside, there were four big coal cellars, one for each family. You got a year's supply of coal for your furnace and your fire. Now the places were furnished. They were very well kitted out, all the pots and pans you could think of, bedding, chairs, table, wardrobes, beds, everything was furnished. Well, when we arrived at the buildings, we found that our flat was the only one that was finished. They were almost finished, the other three flats in our block, but the other two blocks weren't quite completed. So it turned out that I was believed to be the first one to change a station from an island station to a shore station. I was there about a week, finding my way around, and finding out what the routines would be. There was another block of flats, an old that had been there for donkey's years, in the town of Stromness. They were the shore station for a lighthouse called Skerry Vore. So I went there, made myself known, and they put me straight as to what had to be done. And there was a telephone station there at the Skerry Vore station. So you had to get in touch with the lighthouse three times a day. It was 9 in the morning, I think it was 1 o'clock lunchtime, and 6 o'clock in the evening. So I got in touch by radio each day to the Pentland Skerries and let them know what was happening. Neil and I, when we went down the town to start shopping, we found the people we thought they were very peculiar. I thought, oh blimey, they're like the Welsh, it must be as bad as the Welsh people. They looked at you, but they just only spoke when spoken to, and they treated you with very, very, quite suspicious. It was a bit frightening, and I thought, oh blimey, we're not going to be stuck here and be outsiders, are we? And this kept up for a month or two, but once these people got to know you, they were the most hospitable and friendly people that we have ever come across, that I've ever come across in my life. They were the most friendly and helpful people you could ever wish to meet. In fact, I still correspond with them. With one person, anyway. Now, the time came for me, I had to go out to the lighthouse. I felt a bit sorry leaving Nina on her own. So, you had to be taken by taxi from Stromness, right down across the islands, to a place called South Ronaldsay, which was the nearest point to the Pentlandskerries lighthouse. So, during the war, a submarine had managed to get into Scapa Flow and sank the British battleship Royal Oak with a heavy loss of life, terrible loss of life. So Churchill brought out an order to link the islands up with a roadway so that submarines couldn't get through. So numerous prisoners of war were brought up there, and they made huge concrete blocks and they connected quite a few of these islands with these blocks and made a roadway on top. So whereas previously to get from one island to another by boat, you could drive. So to get to South Ronaldsay, we went by taxi over these causeways, or the Churchill Barriers. That is the correct name they are known by. And it was quite a nice ride, quite an experience. On the way from Stromness down to South Ronaldsay, there was a little galvanised iron Nissen hut, just like the army used in the war, semicircle shape. It had been there from the war years. And the Italian prisoners had turned it into a little chapel. And it's still, visitors can still go in and look at it today. Inside, all the walls and the ceiling were all painted with frescoes and religious paintings. Beautiful colours. It was absolutely marvellous. And an altar with a rail in front of the altar. And all this was made from scrap bits and pieces that the prisoners found. It's called the Italian Chapel. And anyone going to Orkney, it's well worth a visit to pay to see it. Anyway, I got down to St. Margaret's Hope, which was the name of the little village there at Long Hope. The chap who drove the taxi, his name is Walter Hancocks, and he is the person that I still correspond with. We've been friends ever since. His father was English. He'd been in the Royal Navy in the First World War, and he'd met Walter's mother in Stromness and married and settled there after the war. His father came from the West Country, Cornwall or something, Cornwall or Devon. So he brought me there, and waiting there was a boat, only a tiny boat. And there were about four of a crew on it. The man in charge of the boat, his name was Willie Budge. B-U-D-G-E, a real Orcadian name, Willie Budge. And he was in charge of the lifeboat, and that's all he'd done was look after this lighthouse boat. He had a house supplied there, and he'd done the trip out once a fortnight with stores, taking coal and oil for the lights and food and one thing or another, and bringing keepers ashore when they're going on holidays. Anyway, I was introduced to him and we set off. Now the Pentland Firth, which runs between Scotland and the Orkneys, is one of the worst currents in the world. I forget the actual speed of it. which you could stare across. Pelton Skerry is only a very, very tiny island. Not much bigger than a football pitch. You could see it, but you couldn't steer straight for it. The tide used to change, of course, and it used to run between the islands and Scotland, but in the middle was like a river going in the opposite direction. You could see the sea going, say, east to west, but in the middle of it, like a roadway of water going west to east. So when the Willie Budge set off in his boat, he steered for the north of Scotland, and the current pulled him towards the Pentland Skerries, and once he got through that current, you could get there. So I landed there, and all the keepers and their wives came down to greet me. We got the stores about shore and mail, one thing or another. And there was a chap, he came from near Glasgow, just forget the name of the place. It was a holiday resort on the Clyde. Him and his wife and their baby were going ashore. So had a quick good hello to them, and then they got on board the boat and they set off. Now they had an old tractor there. It was an ex-RAF tractor used for towing planes out onto the runway during the wartime. So they had this tractor there, which used to pull a little trailer with all the oil drums and stores and everything on up to the station, up to the lighthouse. When I arrived up at the lighthouse, it had been built in the early 1800s. There were actually two towers. I'm looking at a photograph of it as I'm talking. A high tower and a low tower, with the buildings all round the bottom. Now, when it was first built, both towers used to have a light on. And I believe the idea was that ships coming sailing there, once they had to get the two lights in line, one above the other, to get their course. It was like a guide. But that would probably be when they were using oil lanterns. But now they were run by gas, the lights, a mixture of oil fuel and air pressure. So there was only the tallest lighthouse had a light in, and the small tower had a big foghorn built on top, so that when it was foggy you could warn ships by this thing blaring out, a real monotonous note. So that was the station. Now the principal keeper and the first assistant were there. The principal keeper, he turned out to be quite a peculiar chap. His name was Munro, Sandy Munro. His father had been in the lighthouse service, and his grandfather had been in the lighthouse service, so he was a real lighthouse family. He was a chap in his late 50s, mid to late 50s, I suppose. His wife looked a bit older. They had a grown-up daughter living ashore. And then the first assistant keeper, he was an Orcadian. He was born on a little island called Gramsey, just opposite from Stromness. And he was single at the time. So we got introduced to each other, and I got on all right with the first assistant, Jimmy Sinclair, his name was. But this Munro, the lighthouse keeper, he kept calling me a Sassenach. He wasn't too keen on the English. But however, you have to live together, and that was it. So I settled into the routine. You done watch keeping. You done 3 hours on watch and six off. So it wasn't too bad. That was until 9 o'clock in the morning. Then we had breakfast. And then in the morning time, we cleaned all the brasswork and oiled the machinery. There was a big compressor in one of the buildings which ran the foghorn. So you get quite busy. Now the lantern, or the light at the top of the lighthouse, of course you had to circumnavigate the stairs, circular stairs up to the light room. I forget how many stairs there were, but they didn't half get your legs. But after being a conductor on a bus, it wasn't too bad, I suppose. But this massive light was settled floating on a bath of mercury. You could turn it with one hand, but that was because you had to keep everything so clean. If your dust got in, that would stop it. And it was revolved by a cable, a rope, or steel cable rather, which ran the full length height of the lighthouse with a weight on the bottom. So there was a handle there which you had to wind, and wind the weight right up to the top, and then just push the lever and set it in motion, and the weight very, very slowly descended, and that revolved the light. So I forget how long it ran for, about 50 minutes or something like that. So you had to keep watching where it was and then wind it up. That, and you had to keep look out for ships. We used to have to take weather readings, the amount of cloud in the sky, the force of the wind, the rainfall. Then we used to have to put these all on the form, and every so many hours you phoned them to Wick Radio, where there was a meteorological station. So you're helping in the weather forecasts in a slight way. Of course, you had to do your own cooking, so the principal never cooked. But the other two took turns, 1 week on and a week off, of cooking. Now there were no fridges, so we used to salt the meat. When we got to the board, they had fresh meat the day of the relief, perhaps the day after, and then they had steel crocks where we used to put the loads of salt and put the meat in and salt it down, and the same with the fish. We used to have herrings there, we used to salt them down. So yeah, when you come to cook these things, you had to put it in the pan and bring it to a boil. Well, the old sailor's tale was, you brought it to the boil three times. That meant you boiled it, took it off the boil again, then put it back, boiled it up again, took it off, and then boiled it up again. And keep emptying the water each time, and that took most of the salt out. The worst thing was bread. So we used to have loaves sent from ashore, and after a few days it was hard as rock. So what we used to do then, we used to soak them in water, put them in the sink and absolutely soak them, and give them a little bit of a squeeze, take them out of the water, put them on the draining board and let most of the water butter about, and then put them in the oven. And they used to come like fresh again. Of course, that only went on for a week or so, so then you had to start baking bread. Oh, that was the routine on watch. Then we used to be in touch with the shore station 3 times a day, the boulder each day. And on this little island, there was a little walled cemetery. There was quite a big area, which had been walled off for gardens for lighthouse keepers in the years past. But they hadn't bothered using them much, so they were back to grass. But there was a little tiny cemetery there. There were 7 or 8 graves of some men who had been wrecked on a ship in the 1800s, I think it was, the late 1800s. And there were 2 headstones there for 2 children of lighthouse keepers who died out there. It must have been an awful life, having your family out there, in contact with nobody, only yourselves. It'd be like in a prison cell, wouldn't it? And of course, in those days, they didn't have electric light. They only had oil lamps. And the wind howling round. It's a terrible exposed place. I'd been up there quite a while when one of the keepers said to me, "Do you miss anything?" Nothing I can think of. I said, "What do you talk about? The cinemas and shows and television and all that sort of thing." And I said, "No, no," he said, "trees. Don't you miss the trees?" Now, in Orkney, there's hardly any trees at all. There's only one place that I ever saw, halfway between Stromness and Kirkwall, where there was a bit of a dip in the land, where there were trees. A few bushes round houses and that, but no trees at all. So you can see how exposed it was now. It must have been awful for these people. I say it was early 1800s, 1806 or something, 5 or 6, when it was built, Pentland Skerries. And also up in Orkney, in the summertime, the days are very long. In fact, the sun hardly sets. You can go outside walking or driving a car or anything at 2 o'clock in the morning, without any lights on. There's hardly any daylight, any darkness at all. But in the winter time, it's dark until about 11 o'clock in the morning, 10 or 11 in the morning, and it's coming dark again at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We used to put the light on. The lighting up time was 3:20 or something like that in the winter. Gales are furious there, terrific gales. And yet all the time we were up there, we never had a cold. One year there was terrible snowstorms. Another year we were there, there were terrible gales when there was a terrible lot of damage done. A lot of egg farms there with people with hens producing eggs for export. All the hens were killed, thousands and thousands of them. Walls were blown down, houses were blown down. Out on the lighthouse at the Pentland Skerries, the little creek where the boat came in to do the relief to land us, there was a metal crane. An iron crane bedded into the rocks by lead. And the gale had bent that right over as if a giant had twisted it almost into a figure eight. And there were great big metal rings bedded on, big thick pins bedded into the rock for tying the boat up. seas had come and pulled these rings for tying the boat up completely out of the rock. People don't realise what a force the sea is. It's amazing. Terrible, the tales I can tell you, what I've seen up there. The force of the wind. And of course, lighthouses can rock. They can sway a bit. They are wonderful buildings, really. They are built with big granite blocks interlocking like a jigsaw. And so I'm told, if they didn't sway a bit, they would crack and break. Put up in the light room on a really gale force wind, you could feel it all shaking. You had to stand with your legs slightly apart. And the lights would be flickering a bit. Absolutely amazing.
Well, I've got used to the routine of the life on the light. And I really enjoyed it. There were so many variations. It wasn't just keeping a watch that the light was moving, but the maintenance of the station, the engines, polishing, keeping it spotless clean. Then you would return it cooking. And there was so much wildlife on the island. All sorts of birds. Oyster catchers, guillemots, puffin, they used to bury into the ground, burrows, fulmers, great black-backed seagulls, there were a few gannets that used to soar up in the air, they roll their wings and plummet nice, nosedive down into the sea after fish. But the birds that they used to amaze me the most were called the Arctic tern. I forget the date, but it was in springtime. There wouldn't be a single bird on the island these terns. You'd go to bed that night and you'd hear them screaming. When you came outside next morning, the island was absolutely covered with them. They weren't a great big bird, not a very big, not quite as big as the seagull. Their long, sharp beaks, long, pointed beaks. And they didn't make nests, they just flopped down onto the ground. And the island was white with them. Had to be careful going for a walk around, you had to wear a hat and carry a stick and wave it about. Because these would attack you in case you went near their territory. And they laid their eggs, and you had to be careful, you didn't stand on eggs, they could swarm at you if you did. And then, I think it was September, the same date every year, you woke up one morning and absolutely everyone had gone, they wouldn't be there. It was an amazing sight. And there was a man on the radio, I forget his name now, he was the authority on birds, the chairman of different societies. He used to send rings and tags to us to ring the young fulmer birds, just the fulmers, and that was quite a job. Now they nested part way down the cliffs and the rocks and crannies and that. So you used to use rope sometimes to get down to them. And you had to be careful. You had to wear old oilskins for this job, because when you got near them, they opened their mouth and shot a jet of orangey yellow liquid at you. Quite a lot of it. Jetted straight at you over a distance of about 6 foot. And it smelt foul. Smelt to the high heavens. You got it on your clothes, you'd never get rid of the smell. That's the reason we all kept some old oilskin special for that one purpose of bringing these bones. It would be to trace their migratory travels, I suppose. But it was another interest. Another thing I liked, Jimmy Sinclair, he was born on Gramsey, which is just opposite Stromness, Orcadia. He told me that seals liked music. Now I had a ukulele, I had it when I used to do the dance band. And I brought that out with me, strum, and I'd have a little sing-song now and again on my own. So I got my ukulele, and he got a mouthful. And we went and sat on the rock, dangling in the sea, sat on the rocks. We started playing, and about 20, 30 yards, a head popped out of the sea. It was a seal. And another one. And they disappeared. And after a while, the heads popped up again, closer. This went on. Gradually more heads were popping up. And at the end, we had about half a dozen within touching distance. The heads going side to side, listening to the music. They really, really enjoyed the music. And some of them even came out lay on the rocks, close enough. Now some of the men there had been killing young seals against all my principles. But they'd killed them and skinned them. I believe they killed them, hit them on the back of the head. And was it apparently on a seal, there's a soft spot right on the top of the head. Their bodies are covered with so much blood in it, so if you hit them, it wouldn't harm them. But there's this soft spot right on top of the head of them, and a pickaxe handle. They hit them right on top of the head, in this soft spot, and that kills them instantly. And they used to do that, and then they'd skin them. And they're beautiful skins, bird skins, and they made moccasins. I noticed Jimmy Sinclair had a pair of these moccasins, so I took it in, killed on it sometime or other, but I didn't like that at all. I didn't like that at all. Then, there were cormorants. They're a foul, big fish, like a big bird, but they swim underwater and live on fish. Used to be around the coast of the Isle of Man. We used to call them Ginny divers when I was a child. And of course they killed the fish. Now men used to go out in boats and catch things. I wondered what for, and I asked Jimmy Sinclair. He told me they sent them down south to these firms that made chicken paste. Told me that during the war they used to ship them down south. They used to pluck them and deodorize them because they smelled terrible too. They smelled real horrible, these cormorants. And used to be served as chicken during the war years. People didn't know. But a lot of them went to a place called Shippen's. Chicken paste, they made chicken paste. Mina had given me some of this chicken paste to take out for making a sandwich with. But it put me off chicken paste. I never had it after that. It put me right off it. All these activities kept you interested. There's plenty outside in the summertime, but the wintertime you couldn't do much outside, of course, so everybody had their hobbies. Jimmy Sinclair was making the boat. Wood he picked up. He was on it quite a while before I joined the island. It was about a year after I was there before he finally finished. But he made quite a good little dinghy boat. I took a correspondence course at the Chambers Correspondence College. I took a course on it, on English and public health and hygiene. What kept me interested at the time. And there were sheep on the island too. Mr. Budge, the boatman, he had about 30 to 40 there. And the keepers had a couple each. I bought a couple, and it was quite a good proposition. In the spring, Mr. Budge used to come out and used to dip them all. The disinfecting, which you have to do, sheep dip. And he clipped them, him and his crew. We used to help them, of course. And then young male lambs, which they called tups, they castrated them. And then they took the lambs ashore and sold them. The wool was all put into bags, each man his own sheep, he got the wool for his own sheep. And we used to send that down south to a place in Scotland called Broader. Now they used to send you a catalogue and samples of different types of wool you could have it made into. So this was good for Nina, because she'd done a lot of knitting, so she'd have this wool made up as she wanted, different colours and thickness. And that kept her supplied with wool. Plus we got the money from the sheep to keep it sold, a few pounds for them, the lambs. And also you could have the wool made into tartan rugs, which were beautiful. Well, we had some tartan rugs there, I think it was three or four. And we've still got those tartan rugs. That was in the 60s. And here, as I'm talking now, it's 1995. So that's the 50s, rather. It was in the 50s. So these rugs we've got are about 40 years old and they're still good. So there was plenty to do and occupy your mind. And Nina was getting settled ashore. She was getting to know people. They soon were all friendly. And when you went ashore, you had you only got 2 weeks, it went pretty quick. You got into the local community and made a number of friends.